President Trump used losses, write-offs, and real estate tax breaks to avoid paying nearly any federal income taxes at all for years. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The New York Times has more than two decades' worth of the president's tax returns. They show he paid $750 in federal income tax for 2016 and again in 2017, and zero in taxes for 10 of the previous 15 years. President Trump used write-offs, losses, and real estate-related tax breaks to lower or eliminate his tax bill. I asked Julia Coronado, founder of Macro Policy Perspectives, whether in an election year this might end up drawing attention to the tax code itself.
Absolutely. I think we often talk about the marginal tax rates and whether sort of the wealthy should be paying a higher share or whether we should have a wealth tax. This kind of highlights that there's a lot of features of the tax code that we may not focus on that really can affect the outcomes pretty significantly, the ability to write off losses for certain types of businesses that, you know, rank and file wage and salary workers don't have access to.
Friday, we will get the jobs report, the number of jobs created this last month. What do you expect to see?
So it looks like we're still moving in the right direction. Consensus is looking for a gain of about 800,000 jobs. That's a lot of jobs. It still, though, is a smaller gain than we've been seeing in recent months. So we're seeing the momentum slow. And then we've got a couple of clouds on the horizon from the airlines, from small businesses like restaurants running out of PPP money. So there still is a lot of fragility, even though these numbers are still gigantic by historical standards. We've got tens of millions of people unemployed, and we need to be adding those numbers or even better than those numbers to get back to where we want to be.
Julia Coronado, founder of Macro Policy Perspectives, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Gun sales in America were way up over the summer, 70% higher in June compared to a year earlier. At the same time, the nation's oldest gun maker, Remington, filed for bankruptcy. This complicates things for the families of Sandy Hook school shooting victims who are suing Remington. They may get nothing. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
Remington has filed for bankruptcy twice in 2 years. The second time led to an auction of the company's assets. There are now reportedly seven successful bidders, including other firearms manufacturers. A bankruptcy judge will hear the results of the auction tomorrow to consider approving the sell-off of the nearly 200-year-old company. Some three dozen different parties will be present for the hearing, including a lawyer representing Sandy Hook families. They're suing Remington over its marketing of the rifle used in the school shooting that killed 20 first graders and six adults in 2012. The families have questioned the timing of Remington's bankruptcy and were unsuccessful in getting a seat on the creditors committee that helps determine Remington's fate. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Internet companies, websites, have a kind of legal immunity referred to as Section 230 immunity. First, they're generally not responsible if a user of, say, Facebook or Twitter posts something illegal. They're also generally immune from liability if they take down a post that they find objectionable. Users can't really legally challenge that. Well, there are widespread efforts to roll back some of that immunity. We asked Daphne Keller, director of the Program on Platform Regulation at Stanford University's Cyber Policy Center, to walk us through it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what is first the argument in favor of limiting these types of immunity?
Some people want platforms to take down more harmful and offensive content from platforms like Facebook or Twitter. Part of the issue is that a lot of that is what we call lawful but awful speech. It's protected by the First Amendment. But we also see people who want to change the immunity in order to get platforms to leave up more of this lawful but awful speech and compel them to carry things like, maybe racist diatribes or anti-vaccine scientific theories or even potentially electoral misinformation and not give them the leeway to take that stuff down.
What's the downside to having tech platforms, internet sites, be held liable for the content that their users post?
The issue with putting liability on platforms for their users' speech is that it gives them powerful incentives to err on the side of taking things down just in case it's illegal because they don't want to get in trouble. And you can imagine what that would have done to the Me Too movement, for example, if a platform felt like it had to take down any allegation that could possibly prove to be defamatory later on.
Let's turn to the question of whether you can sue, if Instagram takes down your post. What's the downside of seeking to erode that immunity?
It means that platforms will have to worry more about lawsuits from really extreme speakers like Alex Jones would be an example, saying, you have to carry my speech. Even if you don't want to carry Holocaust denial, you have to. Even if you don't want to carry organization for a white supremacist rally like the one in Charlottesville, you have to. And we've seen a number of those lawsuits, and the platforms ultimately win them all. And even without 230, they would ultimately win them all. But it would be much more expensive. Without 230, the nuisance cost of dealing with these lawsuits would be significant. It would give them reason to just, give up and carry it rather than face that burden.
Are we talking about this simply because the president is angry that Twitter moderates his tweets and Facebook takes down some of his political advertisements? I mean, is that what this is about ultimately?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I think the specific proposals we've seen recently, in particular from the Justice Department, those were absolutely prompted by President Trump's executive order. And that seems to have been triggered by Twitter putting a label on his tweets. But overall, the sense of a need to regulate platforms is bipartisan. It's global. It transcends politics. And the sense that platforms are acting as gatekeepers of discourse, that they're the new public square, and that it's kind of crazy that private companies are setting the speech rules, that's global too. In the U.S., it's very much a conservative talking point. But I think in the U.S. and all over the world, everyone has concerns about that. It transcends politics. It's one of the biggest policy questions of our age.
Daphne Keller is director of the Program on Platform Regulation at Stanford University Cyber Policy Center. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.